This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehish Wuhib, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I think it's fair to say that the various Libyan factions are not yet convinced that they will gain more than they will lose by having a new constitution and elections.
That's David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East, speaking about the Libya conference. Details coming up.
Also, the UN Security Council lifts sanctions on Eritrea. And a new report says African capitals and commercial hubs dominate the list of cities that are at extreme risk from climate change.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the United Nations Security Council has lifted an arms embargo and targeted sanctions on Eritrea today. The sanctions were imposed in 2009 after UN experts accused Eritrea of supporting armed groups in Somalia. Eritrea, however, has denied the allegations. To brief us on the matter, we have in studio Tawalda Walda Gabriel from VOA's Horn of Africa service. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you for having me, Hayes.
To start with, Tawalda, could you elaborate more on why the sanctions were imposed almost a decade ago?
As we remember, almost a decade ago, on December 23, 2009, United Nations Security Council had Resolution 1907 and adopted to impose an arms embargo on Eritrea, travel bans on its leaders, and froze the assets of some of the country's political and the military officials. This is after accusing the Eritrean government of aiding al-Shabaab in Somalia and reportedly refusing to withdraw troops from its disputed border with Djibouti following a conflict in 2008.
So all these years, how did the president of Eritrea, Isaias Afwerki, cope with the situation?
That was a difficult time for Eritrea. It was not really easy, but the government was campaigning against the sanctions for years with the help of its citizens, basically, mainly in diaspora. But the government has a policy of self-reliance, like fighting alone from its history, back from its history. That happened for about 10 years, but now here we are.
So, Tawalda, what instigated the liftings of these sanctions now?
The United Nations Security Council, as you mentioned in your news, just lifted the nearly decade arms embargo and targeted sanctions on Eritrea. This came after Ethiopia and Eritrea in July of this year declared an end to their state of war and agreed to open embassies, develop ports, and resume flights between the two countries after decades of hostilities. Eritrea has also improved the relations with Djibouti after both leaders met in Saudi Arabia, which was one of the factors for the sanctions.
So now with the lifting of sanctions, what kind of Eritrea is likely to emerge?
Well, the biggest question Eritreans are hoping is that the diplomatic frenzy or the diplomatic excitement with Ethiopia may also lead to a change at home. So the biggest question for many Eritreans is whether there will be any change to the national service program, which includes a period of military training before recruits are funneled into jobs. And they are hoping the government open free market where citizens can open up private businesses, including construction businesses, which is important. The government has been applying a tight control on private construction, including building houses.
So we're talking about a bright future for that for Eritrea. That was told Walde Gabriel from VOA's Horn of Africa service, who just, by the way, returned from a visit to Eritrea. Thanks for your input.
Thank you. Yeah, I just came back, and what I have observed is, you clearly see the impact of the peace deal with Ethiopia, food or consumer goods, especially non-durable goods such as food and the consumer goods construction materials that are imported through the border with Ethiopia are sold at a very low cost. The livelihood in Eritrea has been changed, although slowly. But the exchange of people, the reconnection of people are happening as we speak.
Again, thank you.
Thank you, Ace.
And in other news, Italy and the United Nations praised the International Conference on Libya as a success, despite the stark divisions that emerged among key players in the country. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte and the UN envoy to Libya, Ghassan Salame, said all parties had agreed to hold a UN conference in January to prepare for elections and measures to end the Libyan crisis. 2 days of talks and suspense in Palermo saw eastern Libyan strongman Khalifa Haftar show up but snub the actual sessions, preferring instead to hold a series of meetings on the sidelines. Ambassador David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi about what the international conference failed to achieve.
I'm afraid that this conference is going to be a disappointment over the long term. Essentially, what happened is that the international community created a venue in which the Libyan factions could, if they were prepared to do so, use the venue to make some major statements about an agreement to continue with the Libyan political accord agreed in Skhirat, but to change the names of the presidential council so that they could move on to a proper constitutional process. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. I think it's fair to say that the various Libyan factions are not yet convinced that they will gain more than they will lose by having a new constitution and elections.
So what should be the next step after Palermo?
Well, the one agreement from the Palermo conference is to have a Libyan conference in Tripoli in which the different factions would be represented, and it would be up to them to reach a conclusion that they could say is a Libyan conclusion that they reached without pressure from the outside. That's, I would say, a long shot. If it works, well and good. But just imagine if our own country, the United States of America, when we have the Constitutional Convention meeting in Philadelphia, if all of the American representatives had said, oh, we can't reach a decision because the British ambassador and the French ambassador and the Spanish ambassador are all in disagreement, if they had blamed it on the international forces. No, in our own history, we know that they made hard compromises so that they could get started with a process of ratification of a constitution and holding elections for a new government.
Do you envision any U.S. role to facilitate reaching a solution in Libya?
No, I don't. I don't think that the Trump administration is interested in being engaged in Libya beyond counterterrorism efforts. And the counterterrorism efforts have been reasonably successful, but they've reached a point where you would have to have a political agreement in order to close the door to a reentry of foreign terrorists and creation of a new terrorism problem based in Libya.
That was Ambassador David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi.
Cameroon's restive English-speaking regions are emptying out after renewed military raids on separatist strongholds left at least 30 people dead in 2 days. The renewed fighting comes barely a week after President Paul Biya, during his inauguration ceremony, warned rebels to drop their guns or be killed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, where thousands of fleeing civilians are arriving.
Nso and Wimbum people from the English-speaking northwest region of Cameroon sing and dance to welcome some of the thousands of people who fled fighting in their villages. 19-year-old businessman Kenneth Kongu says he fled in a group of 75 as the military clashed with Anglophone separatists who want to form an independent state they call Ambazonia.
So when we arrived there, we see around 300 people there. They were even asking me, where am I going? Let them join me. I said, I'm just going to nowhere. I'm afraid. They are killing people every day, both the Ambazonia fighters and the military. When they come in the market, they shoot from every angle.
Cameroon's military spokesperson, Colonel Didier Bajek, on Wednesday said the death toll from clashes the last few days had increased to more than 30, all of them separatists. Ambazonian Defense Force spokesman Ivo Tapang told Reuters news agency only 2 separatist fighters died, while their forces killed 13 government troops. 17-year-old Oscar Tata says he is a former separatist fighter. He says he was nearly killed when the military attacked their training camp of 80 young fighters in Kambe.
So my journey, because they have killed their family members, their father, maybe their mother or their father or their brothers, so they don't have anybody to rely on again. That's the reason why some are joining. I'm pleading on the government to try and solve the problem so that we, the youth, we can go back to school.
Elvis Tadze, community leader from Kambe, notes police often suspect displaced people of being separatist supporters and search their houses.
People need to continuously cluster together, sensitizing each person or each member of each group or community to do the right thing, and doing the right thing is to respect the law and follow the norms. They should avoid being exposed to circumstances. They should be law-abiding.
During his inauguration on November 6, President Paul Biya told fighters to drop their guns or be killed. He promised to pardon those who stopped fighting. Political analyst Gabriel Su says the rebels are showing no signs of surrendering. He says Cameroon may be in for carnage if Biya does not negotiate with the separatists whose leaders live in exile.
Why can't the government invite those in the diaspora to come to the negotiating table where there's no intimidation? They can talk one-to-one, ask them what they need and what they want and what they don't want. We should dialogue amicably.
Some political leaders have called on Biya to initiate dialogue with the separatists. But Biya, who has ruled Cameroon for 36 years, has refused any talks on Cameroon becoming a divided state. Cameroon, a former French colony, has been troubled by unrest since separatists in 2 English-speaking regions in 2016 said they wished to form a new country. Biya declared war on them, calling them terrorists for attacks that killed government troops. In January, Cameroon extradited from Nigeria the self-proclaimed leader of Ambazonia, Ayuk Tabe Julius, along with 47 of his supporters. Since then, separatists have been attacking schools, killing and kidnapping teachers, students, and workers to make the English-speaking regions ungovernable. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A new report says African capitals and commercial hubs dominate the list of cities that are at extreme risk from climate change. The 2018 Climate Vulnerability Index is based on UN data compiled by risk analyst firm Verisk Maplecroft. The study says the cities are so focused on dealing with existing issues such as poverty, poor sanitation, and shortages of clean water, power, and housing that they don't have the resources to prepare for climate change. The situation is further complicated by rapid population growth and job shortages that lead to urbanization. As an example, it says Kinshasa's population of 13 million is expected to double by 2035. The Climate Vulnerability Index says 84 of the world's 100 fastest-growing cities are at extreme risk, including 79 in Africa. They include 15 national capitals. It says the impact of climate change could also foster higher crime rates and unrest.
Many African countries, nations, are struggling to meet the needs of rapidly growing populations. Health experts, policymakers, and family advocates say lack of access to family planning tools, from education to affordable contraceptive methods, worsen the poverty and bad living conditions of millions of sub-Saharan Africans. Hundreds of experts this week are gathered in Kigali for the 5th International Conference on Family Planning. Eugene Uimana reports from Kigali.
Many family planning activists urge Africans to bide farewell to the saying that if God brings a child, his plate come too. Rwanda's First Lady Jeannette Kagame rallied women in leadership to voice concerns on family planning services if they are to make a critical contribution to sustainable development.
So we need to ask ourselves, what socioeconomic achievements should our communities aspire to be convinced of the long-term benefits of determining the number of births according to one's economic abilities while spacing them out for healthier babies and women.
Several family planning organizations say the welfare of women means the development of the nation. Beth Stratcher is the head of Family Planning 2020, a global organization.
So high population growth can be an impediment to all development indicators, and it has really personal impacts on women and families. You generally see there higher rates of maternal death as well, women having repeat pregnancies before their bodies have a chance to recover. And we know that when a family loses a mother, their economic prospects diminish incredibly. The chance for those children to stay in school, they go down. So if we can't keep mothers alive, if we can't keep women healthy, then a country really is under a burden to try and grow economically.
Every other year since 2009, the International Conference on Family Planning, ICFP, has brought together the family planning community to share best practices and identify steps toward the goal of enabling an additional 120 million women to access voluntary contraception by 2020. The World Health Organization says that about 3,000 women die each year from complications due to pregnancy and childbirth. WHO estimates that approximately at least a quarter of those women could be saved if they had access to contraception. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Africa's longest suspension bridge has opened in Mozambique. It eliminates the sometimes deadly ferry crossings between Maputo and Katembe, a connecting road linking the capital with South Africa's KwaZulu-Natal province, has also been upgraded, cutting the journey from 6 hours to just 90 minutes. Vicky Stark reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
The Maputo-Katembe Bridge is an exciting development for trade and tourism along this stretch of Indian Ocean coastline. The 3 kilometer construction costs close to $800 million and was mostly funded by loans from the Chinese. The Asian giant also built the bridge with quality control oversight by German engineers Hof. Mozambique and South Africa are hoping that the greatly reduced travel time between the two countries will appeal to both local and international visitors. In the border town of Ponta Dora, the Dolphin Center's manager Gilberto Mohai tells us what it was like before.
It was difficult for most of the South Africans to cross by Ponta Dora, and using the ferry was a very long queue there that I've seen.
He's hopeful there'll be a building boom in the area.
There is still a lot of things here in Kwanta to explore, or companies to be opened, and they couldn't do that because there was no road. The accessibility to Ponta, it was very difficult. So now with this bridge and the road, the tar road that comes straight to Ponta, I think will bring more people that are interesting to develop Ponta or to do something in Ponta, especially like shops, ShopRite, things like that. We don't have here in Ponta.
And what's on offer at his dolphin center?
We search for the dolphins. To swim with them is not guaranteed because that will depend on their behavior. Yeah, we check their behavior first before we can interact with them. If they're social, then they will interact with us. If they're not, we don't arrest them. We don't follow them. We just leave them until they feel comfortable to come close to us to swim.
On the South African side, the World Heritage Site Isimangaliso Wetland Park is a popular attraction. Brand manager Thandi Shabalala says they're expecting a significant increase in tourists.
They would choose the other route, which would take them into Swaziland instead, so which would mean that they would not come via us because of the condition of the road. Now the road has been built, and with the bridge, it will make it even easy for people to stay over.
And what makes the wetland so special?
During summer months, we have turtles that come out to lay eggs. And then in winter, we have whales that come by our shores here. So you can see southern right whales and humpback whales.
Spokesperson for KwaZulu-Natal's Economic Development, Bongani Tembe, says they're counting on tourism to provide employment in the province.
We want a situation where Mozambique benefits from us, and we also benefit from them in terms of tourism. And our plan is to grow in the next 5 years. Our plan is to grow our tourism industry in such a way that it will be able to create about 800,000 jobs.
A toll fee of about $3 is being charged to cross the bridge. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America in Johannesburg.
That wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC. For another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Suleiman Terawali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
Is there a leadership deficit in Africa? Does the continent lack leaders who are compassionate about their citizens and believe in strong institutions? Host Shaka Sali returns to lead a discussion on the importance of strong leaders and strong institutions on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
The 2019 Voice of America calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture the beautiful byways of the United States, including magnificent photos of California's Big Sur Coast Highway, West Virginia's Highland Scenic Highway, and even the Cato All-American Road in Maine. Tune into Border Crossings and call to request a free calendar.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.